Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health, your well-being, and just generally having a greater expansive knowledge of who you are and the world you live in. Well, I am back in the U.S. today. I've been gone for quite a while over in Australia on a lecture tour. It's been an amazing journey, and it's always great to return and always sad to leave a place I really love, but I will be back again next year, so it's not so bad. And for those of you who are listening for the first time, I want to personally welcome you. I have a great website, which is whatwomenmustknow.com. If you opt in there, you get several of my special free reports. I have many free articles and videos, special reports of all sorts, great information to just keep you on the leading edge of what's going on. And I have a very active Facebook as well, which is What Women Must Know. So if you feel so inclined, go over there and like me at What Women Must Know, because I post daily articles, information, recipes, information that really is of practical benefit for you. So there you go. Lots of great opportunities to learn and to really become more aware of who we are and what we are. You know, I just want to say that one of the reasons I had to return to Australia so soon after just having a tour there was to help a friend who had an unexpected health emergency. So what happened was there was a rupture of his abdominal aorta artery. In the process of that surgery, his spleen was injured, so that had to be removed, and a few other things that went on. And I went down to Australia to support him in recovering from his health and healing. His doctors were phenomenal. They saved his life. No one actually has ever survived the number of surgeries he had in the short period of time, so he was a living legend already within the hospital scene. But it's really interesting when you get past a crisis, when that situation is over, you are then released to your own cognizance, so to speak, and basically have to fend for yourself. So it was such a gift to have access to all of the resources and knowledge and healing modalities, as well as very talented healers that were in my community in Melbourne, Australia, because now the real work began, how to help his body repair, rejuvenate, regenerate from a very, very severe trauma. So the good news is a month after, or 6 weeks after the event occurred, 4 weeks after he was released from the hospital, he actually is thriving and doing really well. And the reason I bring this up is because, first of all, we're going to have a great conversation about the gift of adversity. When life throws us curves and when we have unexpected dramas, events that challenge us, what do we do about that? And the other point I wanted to mention about this incident was how valuable it is to be informed, to be knowledgeable, to have access to resources, particularly healing resources in this case, but always inner resources that we can call upon and bring forth in times of challenging experiences and adversity. And I'm so glad I'm a naturopathic doctor. I'm so glad I am open and curious to learn and heal, because as a result of the knowledge that I have had in the past and gained while I was down there in Australia, we were able to have remarkable recovery from a very serious and life-threatening condition. So that's the good news. And that's kind of a segue into my guest today. I'm very privileged to have with me Dr. Norman E. Rosenthal. He is a very, very respected and well-known, he is a author. He is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. He conducted research at the National Institute of Mental Health. And as a research fellow, researcher, and senior researcher for more than 20 years, was the first psychiatrist to describe and diagnose seasonal affective disorder. And Dr. Rosenthal is a highly cited researcher and the author of more than 200 scholarly articles, as well as books for the general public, including Winter Blues and The Emotional Revolution. And his new book, which is on the bestsellers list now, is called The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you, Dr. Rosenthal, to the show today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the success of your book. It's doing so well, and that always deserves a great big pat on the back, Dr. Rosenthal.
Well, thank you. I think there are not as many readers these days as there used to be, so it's quite challenging. One thing I've done is to write a book that has very short chapters, because I think that all of our attentions have been shaped by the Internet, where we click on the hyperlinks here, there, and everywhere. So I've kept the chapters short so that they're tailored to the mind of the age of the Internet.
Well, you know, we have to do whatever works. And I always like short chapters and big typeface. I can read a book easily these days. So obviously you're doing something right, because there has been a great response to your book. And fortunately there are readers out there and listeners, and the message is getting out, because that's really the key and the purpose for which you are writing, is really to give people the resources to deal with, in this case, adversity. And, you know, that's part of life, isn't it? We have to understand that life isn't about always being happy and smooth sailings. That's kind of a fairy tale fantasy we all somehow picked up along the way, but it has nothing to do with the reality and the vicissitudes of life, as I like to call them. So we need to understand that at some point in one's life, we're going to be experiencing something which could be called adversity. And I really want to explore, from your perspective and your research and your many years of not only as a researcher, but researching inner states of consciousness and inner resources, how best to support everyone as they go through these times, when they approach and when we're in them, such as the one I just experienced. What do we do to move us to deal with the situation at hand as best we can, and then to move forward? So that's where we're going to go today.
Well, I think those are excellent questions. The first thing is to recognize that the adversity is existing. How many cases have we heard of people with chest pain who say, oh, you know, that's probably just indigestion playing up? Now, if they really took their time, they would know that it's a little bit different from indigestion. They haven't actually eaten anything lately. They've been having chest pains while walking strenuously recently. And everybody knows chest pain, get to the ER ASAP. And, but denial is going to potentially cost you your life. And just while I'm on the subject, don't get into your car and drive yourself to the ER. Call 911, because for a couple of reasons. Firstly, you could have a heart attack on your way. Secondly, you're putting stress on your system by trying to drive there. But most important, once you get to the ER, if you haven't come in via an ambulance, you could be an ingrown toenail for all they care about. So this is, accept that the adversity is happening, analyze the situation, and take the correct steps. That sounds like it is what happened in your friend's case, and I'm very glad the situation turned out as well as it did.
Oh, well, thank you. And, yeah, I think so much of the time we are in a state of denial. I think there's just something about our consciousness that doesn't quite believe that something could be radically altered in our life. You know, we just assume things are going to go on as they've always been, and when change is staring us in the face, there's a part of us that just finds it really hard to accept it.
I think that's right. So accepting is important, analyzing the situation. And this could be a personal situation, it could be, and there are many examples in my book. One example that I have used is that my mother in her mid-70s was sleeping alone in her bedroom, or she thought she was alone, and then woke up in the middle of the night with three thugs on top of her. and they were attacking her and assaulting her, and she understood immediately they want money and they want anonymity. And she said to them, if you get off of me, I'll give you money and I'll escort you without seeing your faces. And the miracle of it was that in the middle of the night, three young thugs listened to the words of an old woman, got off of her, she gave them money, she showed them the door, she said, I have not seen your faces, you've got no blood on your hands, go. And they went. That was an instantaneous, accurate assessment of a situation that saved her life.
So
it is in many different situations. You have to assess the situation, and if you have the chance, as you pointed out in your introduction, reach out for help from friends and experts, because mostly in this world, we're not alone.
You know, I am presently involved in a called a teleseminar summit called The Cure to Cancer. So it's bringing together many of the experts who are dealing with many alternative approaches to the treatment and also prevention of cancer. And I think if we're talking about adversity, because I'm dealing with this subject, because I have people around me who have had a diagnosis of cancer, that's something that absolutely strikes heart into the very, you know, fear into the heart of anyone that hears that word, and it certainly would be considered an event of adversity.
Oh, yes.
You said something in your book that I thought was really profound, and that is when you get a situation, if we're talking about the cancer diagnosis, when you hear that diagnosis come across, the most important thing is to take time to evaluate what has just happened rather than get into a panic state, because most of the time when you hear a diagnosis, you're not even present. You're in a state of trauma, actually.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think cancer is one of those buzzwords that does strike fear into the heart of all of us. I think the important thing about cancer is it's not what it used to be. I mean, sometimes it is, but there are so many variations of cancer, some of which are sort of eminently curable. So I think it really behooves people not only to analyze things intellectually, but not to put themselves through more stress than is necessary. You know, it's obvious, it's often the case to go to bad places. Oh, I remember Uncle so-and-so and how he suffered and so on and so forth. You could take yourself to a bad place in your head that you may be borrowing trouble unnecessarily.
And to take the time to look at what your situation is, what your options are, rather than to just rush headlong into making decisions without fully understanding or getting two or three assessments, and just calming down.
Yes, I say, you know, proportion your response according to the adversity. In other words, if you have a mouse in your house, you know, put down a mouse trap. Don't sort of sit on your rocker with an AK-47 aimed at the mouse hole.
Right, and so how would you advise people who've had this, if we're talking about the subject of cancer, of course it could be many, many, many types of adversity. How do you counsel people? They come to you, I know you are in practice, and where would you begin?
Well, I would begin exactly where I'm suggesting other people begin, by trying to understand, what is this type of cancer? What have you learned about it? Who have you been to see about it? And so on and so forth. I was just having lunch with a colleague who had prostate cancer and researched it very, very thoroughly. And he'd gone to a place where they recommended surgery, but through his research in his particular case, he figured radiation was the better choice. And, you know, you can go to different people and they'll give you different opinions, so you have to kind of get the experts talking to each other to understand, you know, what's going on here. I have a friend and colleague who is, you know, in a position to get the best doctors, yet they've given him contrary advice. And so it takes energy and getting people on board and taking people you trust and figuring out. So I would sit down with that person and try to really understand. I wouldn't go into, you know, what happened when you were a child and how did your mother treat you. I would really much rather drill down into the threat in question, you know?
Right.
In terms of, yeah, deal with a situation at hand.
With what's happening in the present and just
and
understand it from as many angles as possible.
Exactly.
You know, you have some interesting information about why you need to know your brain when dealing with adversity. Can you elaborate on that? Because I find that really fascinating.
Yes, you know, we may all look very similar, but actually our brains are all very different. And there's a great strength in knowing what you're good at and what you're bad at. I give an example. For example, my attention would drift, and it was before ADD was understood, and certainly nobody was being treated for it. But I was being given the option of studying history, which meant large volumes. This was in high school, in my last year of high school, large volumes and tomes. And I was being given the option of studying history or studying applied mathematics, and I just happened to be good at mathematics. And the principal was putting pressure on me to study history. And this was a man who, in the early part of the book, you see caning me rather brutally and, you know, behaving in a rather bad way. And so when it came to his opinions about what I needed for my education, needless to say, I was not that enchanted with his opinion. But it will turn out to be the best decision that I didn't try to struggle with something that wouldn't have worked well for my brain, which was assimilating huge volumes of information, and that I did something that came more naturally to me, and that I didn't let an authority figure bash me about and push me into an area that I didn't feel was right for me. And I think we have those choices again and again. A parent wants a child to become a lawyer, but the child doesn't want to, you know, read legal briefs every day. Or whatever it is, we have these influences being put upon us to do various things, and we need to understand who we are as people and how our brain works, because as they say, as Confucius said, if you love your job, you'll never work a day in your life. Mm-hmm. So to love your job, you need to pick a job that works for your particular brain.
Yes, and I feel really blessed because I love what I do, and I don't think of it as a tedious task. So it is a gift, and I'm sure you feel the same way, and especially because you're expressing so many of your creative gifts in your life through your work, through your writings. Wonderful.
Yeah, it has been very joyful and very lucky, but it's also been because the choices have been right for me. And as I write in my book, my parents did not want me to become a psychiatrist. I think they felt like all the family secrets would be revealed. And guess what? Here they are in the gift of adversity. I'm just kidding.
You tell a lot about your story and some of those family secrets, but what I have learned from looking into your book and just listening and doing my research with you is that you are such a living example of experiencing the gift of adversity. You've had many adversities in your life, and you've turned them into lemonade, so to speak. And I'd like you to address that, because I have a belief system that what we call adversity, the challenges that we're faced with, are experiences that we have on some level chosen to encounter to allow us to grow, expand, become more of who we are, just tap into a greater strength. With 2020 hindsight, you know, obviously when we're in the middle of it, we're scared and frightened, but I think it's really important to keep a perspective that at some point in time there is a greater purpose for everything we're experiencing that will be treasured in our lives in the future.
And yeah, I think it's right. I think, you know, in these 52 chapters, and it sounds like a lot, but it's not a very long book because each chapter is just 3 or 4 pages. In these 52 chapters, every chapter ends with a little take-home lesson that I learned that I want to pass on to the reader. And my goal in doing so is to say, hey, maybe you can learn from my experience. Maybe you can get the benefit from my experience. See how I processed this in a way that's helped me. And maybe you don't have to have this particular adversity. And so that's a big piece of the goal. I mean, part of the book is really I'm a storyteller. I love telling stories. I love seeing people moved by what I have to say, laughing, crying, whatever it is, because the feelings are powerful or genuine. So part of it is telling stories and being an entertainer, but part of it is also being a healer, which is, you know, a big piece of my identity.
You know, I'd like you to tell a bit about your story. I know you've been doing that a lot in your interviews, but I think it's quite instructive. And particularly what I'd like you to talk about, Dr. Rosenthal, is that experience after you've had some of these traumas. And I was reading about being reborn and that feeling, that shift that happened to you within you as a result of some of the adverse experiences that you had. Because we're in a process, you know. We have an adverse experience. We have a challenge. We have some crisis in our life, but it's part of a continuum, and we need to understand what happens as that continuum unfolds.
Yes, I think you may be referring to the time that I was sort of brutally stabbed when I was in Johannesburg as a very young man, and came within, I was going to say within an inch of my life, but it was really a quarter of an inch of my life. And, in fact, your friend, you said, had suffered damage to his aorta. And as we know, the aorta is a key artery that takes blood everywhere throughout the body. And in this attack, which occurred with an 18-inch sharpened screwdriver, the screwdriver missed my aorta by a quarter of an inch. And the surgeon came in after the operation when I was conscious again, and he said, if it had been a quarter of an inch the other way, that would have been it for you. So in talking to people, incidentally, I have found that many people have had this quarter of an inch experience. Your friend just had it.
Mm-hmm.
A quarter of an inch, and it would have been it. And so many of us say, you know, if the car had only hit me at a slightly different angle, that would have been it. So, you know, we who are living are lucky. We have survived thus far. And that's what I was really struck by when I recovered from the stabbing. I thought, wow, you know, I've been given the whole opportunity to live again. And the vitality that confronted me in the wake of this trauma was just wonderful. It was just joyful. And so it was like being reborn. In fact, at the beginning of that chapter, I quote from a prophet, Micah. I say, and as for me, I was full of power. It was the Spirit of the Lord. Now, those people out there listening, whether you are religious or whether you're atheists or whatever, I'm not coming at this from even a religious point of view. I'm coming at it from the point of view of feeling like some outside power has kind of entered into you and given you the force and the drive to propel yourself forward in life that you just dare not ignore because it's so important. It's just so important to treasure every day, to do everything you can to make your life good and useful, not just to be a useful agent for other people, which of course is important in its own right, but to live as fully as possible for yourself, to be happy, to be fulfilled. Seize the moment, seize the day.
And that would have had to have been a transformational experience because to realize the quarter of an inch was the difference between being here and not being here.
Transformational is the right word, because it was so interesting. You know, I looked at my day planner that I always have kept a day planner now for whatever, 40-plus years, and I looked at it, and I saw that in the 2 or 3 weeks that I was out of commission, there were all sorts of things that I'd had to do. Pull Mrs. So-and-so's blood, find out what her lab results are, go order her x-rays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, well, who did all those things? I didn't know who did them, but it didn't matter. You know, either they got done or they didn't get done. As they say, the cemeteries are full of indispensable people. And it just gave me a completely different perspective.
It would be more expansive than just getting, taken up with this small, little, insignificant, seeming, from that perspective, details of life that in the scheme of things will either get handled or they won't, but it's not, the world's going to keep turning.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And in that year that followed, I got married, we conceived our child, I entered the South African military. It was one of the most passionate, vibrant, exciting, joyful years of my life.
I was just going to ask, Dr. Russell, do you think that what you learned from that experience still is there guiding you or having an impact in your perception of your life at this moment in time?
You know, I really do, because I think it sort of shaped my life. And, you know, just having written about it reinforces that awareness. You know, and having thought about the book, and the book initially was, you know, lessons learned in the course of a lifetime. What are the stories that go behind the lessons that I've learned? And as I looked over these lessons, it occurred to me that we learn the most when things go wrong. You know, they say you cannot become a master sailor on calm seas. Well, that is how it is. When things go wrong, that's when you learn the most.
And that's when you're forced to grow. We can become very complacent with who we are and how we're living. But suddenly we are forced to have to gain more inner resources, a greater perspective on the meaning of life and who we are.
Yep, indeed.
Well, that's a good place for us to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to be learning more from Dr. Norman E. Rosenthal, the author of The Gift of Diversity, and how we can reap more of the benefits, the gifts that come from life's adversities. So stay tuned. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and you are listening to What Women Must Know. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're having a wonderful conversation with Dr. Norman E. Rosenthal, who is the author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections, a topic that really is so relevant for just about all of us. So, Dr. Rosenthal, I know you have many great stories and examples in the book. Can you share one of your favorite ones as an inspiration for us in understanding more about the gifts of adversity?
You know, I almost feel like Sophie's Choice, you know. you love all your children, you know, so it's kind of difficult. And it really depends on one's mood because, you know, some are very funny and some are kind of sad. And I guess just a funny one is, you know, my dad was a lawyer, and I have a little chapter called A Fixer, because people came to him to fix their problems. And it amuses me as a therapist and as a psychiatrist where people come to us and we, you know, we tease out from them what do they think, what do they feel, what do they think would be best. And of course, it's not just a caricature. It's because we're not only trying to help them solve this particular problem, but to develop a way of thinking that is going to stand them in good stead to solve other problems in the same way. But my dad was not a therapist. He was a fixer. So one of my school teachers came to him and confessed that she had had an affair. And that her husband suspected it, and he'd been a good husband, and she didn't want to lose him. And he said, you know, you're going to have to just lie to him about it. And, you know, I mean, it's funny to me as a psychiatrist because, I mean, I would never tell somebody lie about something, you know. But he wasn't a psychiatrist. He was a fixer. And, you know, it all worked out for them. And then another teacher's husband came to him and said, you know, I was entrapped by a streetwalker. I thought she had the hots for me, but apparently not, because the next thing I knew, after I got into the room with her, her husband was there taking pictures of me with her and then threatening to blackmail me. And my father said, what do they want? He said, they just say, if you pay $100, then we'll go away. And he said, absolutely not. Don't pay them a cent, because they're just going to up their, you know, demands. You go and tell your wife right away, you know, what the story is. And so there he had given very opposite advice to two different people. And in both cases, it worked out and the marriages survived. And I don't say everybody was happily ever after, but it was as happy as they ever had been before. And, you know, so just the picture of a character who everybody went to, who never judged, you know. He wasn't there to judge you. He was there to fix your problem for you. And I also talk about a situation where I was caught by the South African police with a girlfriend in a car. And sure enough, I got him in on the case, and he came in, and he just fixed everything. He just got sweet-talked everybody and got everybody calmed down, and it was amazing to watch. So that's just a little humorous thing that I shared with the reader.
So when we are faced with adversity, what are some practical steps?
Okay. So we said accept it, recognize it, analyze it, proportion your response to the adversity, but then you need to start working on your internal state. Adversity unsettles us. It disrupts our sleep. It disrupts our daily rhythms, our appetite. There is a tendency to do bad things, to get into bad habits, drinking, smoking, fast foods, etc. So we have to do all the opposite kinds of things. We have to consolidate our physiology, get our sleep regularized. And I talk about how to do that and how to strengthen circadian rhythms with the use of bright light in the morning and dim light in the evening to consolidate our circadian rhythms. And then one of my favorite things is meditation. As people who have read my previous book know, I am the lucky transformational story of transcendental meditation that calmed me, settled me down, and activated me in a good way, enabling me to write other books, including The Gift of Adversity. So these are things that we need to do to change ourselves internally. A lot of people are going to focus on what can we do to change the world around us. And sure, you know, go ahead, do that. But at the same time, don't forget, your internal state is going to be crucial to how successfully you process the world around you.
And I think that's so profound. We need to really, first of all, understand that when we're under stress, we are so tempted to try to medicate our fear or our anxiety with alcohol or drugs or food or sex or whatever it is. But in the end, that will only further cause greater imbalance to occur within us, which is the last thing in the world we want to be doing. So I just appreciate that advice. We have to stay centered, and we have to stay loving to ourselves and nurturing ourselves and doing whatever it takes to be as balanced in the midst of the storm as we can.
I think that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So that's another thing. I talk about the importance of cultivating good habits, because it's not good enough to do this for just one day and then pack your bags and you think you can get out of there. You can't. You've got to have to do it every day until you get yourself sorted out. And I quote the American author Annie Dillard. I was walking down Central Park West one day, looked up at the church bulletin board and saw a quote by her. And the quote was, "How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives." Mm. And it was like I registered it with a shock. Yes, how we spend our days is how we spend our lives. And so each day we have to do the things to renew ourselves that are going to strengthen us and make us more able to face the world and succeed in our personal lives.
You know, I want to go back to what you said just a little while ago, and that was the role of transcendental meditation, which is your path. But meditation in general, or meditative practices, or even deep relaxation exercises, whatever you want to call it, plays a major role in helping us cope with adversity. Can you elaborate a little bit based on your experience with meditation?
Yes, well, you know, I can elaborate based on my understanding as a scientist who's reviewed the literature very thoroughly and on my personal experience. You know, as a scientist, I know that meditation, transcendental meditation is the one I'm talking about now because that's what I know the most about, lowers blood pressure, makes you less likely to have a stroke or a heart attack, and prolongs life. In addition, it is anti-anxiety and can help people with anxiety problems and depression problems, and it enhances creativity. All of these have been amply demonstrated with multiple controlled studies. Personally, what I noticed was it slowed me down. It enabled me to think before responding. I became more responsive and less reactive. If somebody said something nasty to me, I wouldn't snap back. I would think, what's going on here? Why is this person saying this? How can I understand it? And the world has changed for me because I've changed. I've just become a nicer person, which makes sense because a stressed person is not going to be a nice person. You're going to snap. You're going to be quick to rush to judgment. You're going to want to get rid of stress, and it backfires. I was walking in the airport recently, and I brought my wheelie in, and I saw there was this little thing that says, if your wheelie doesn't fit in here, you can't bring it on the plane. I looked down at my wheelie. It was not going to fit in that little thing. And there was this really, you know, angry-looking woman monitoring it, and she said, that wheelie's going to have to be checked in. I said, oh, please, what if I took some of this stuff out here and I put it in my personal... No, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. I looked at her and I said, can you help me work this out together? Can we find a solution together? She turned to her companion there and she said, that's the first person who's spoken nicely to me in months and months and months. She said, sure, honey, let's figure this out. And we figured it out, you know. But it was just a little bit of kindness coming from a place of a settled mental state. It was nothing really special. The thing that is so sad is to think that from this woman's point of view, it was such a rarity for anybody to treat her with any decency or respect.
That's a great example. I really love that. I also want to have you comment about the therapeutic role of telling your story as a way of processing the trauma or the situation that one is in or has just recently been in. What are your thoughts about that?
Yes. What I was so happy to do was to feature the work of my colleague James Pennebaker. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Texas in Austin. And Dr. Pennebaker has been a pioneer in developing something called the writing exercise, which is a way of writing down your deepest thoughts and feelings. And only over like a 10-day period, you have to do it for a total of 1.5 hours. And I've included, with his kind permission, in the appendix, exactly how you do this exercise and the long-term effects just of these four 20-minute sessions are beyond belief. From getting hired more quickly after being fired to improving your immune system for months and months after the writing exercise to all sorts of benefits. Controlled studies have shown the power of processing with your left analytic verbal hemisphere the turbulence that's going on elsewhere in the brain.
That's so interesting. So by processing or by writing or expressing the situation, it actually is altering our perception or we're accessing more insight. Is that what you would say? Or
some kind of a processing is going on, and I don't think the exact neural mechanism is fully known, but what is known is that it makes a difference on many different outcomes. So we can only assume that we are processing things in a useful and in a meaningful way where language and writing is brought into the process.
Interesting. And I also want to have your thoughts about the role of reframing adversity. You talk about reframing or about which means thinking about it in a different way. What is that about? Why is that important? And what role does it play in helping people move through adversity?
Well, really, the whole book is a reframe because it's paradoxical to talk of the gift of adversity. It's not usual to think of adversity as a gift, and that's why the element of surprise is there. But the reframe that goes throughout the book is that whenever bad things happen, there is something to be learned or something to be gained. And so it's valuable, even as you're going through adversity, to say, wait a sec, it is possible that when I come out of this, and I saw how you phrased your introduction, in the midst of the adversity, it's very, very hard to see anything but the pain, the suffering, the grief, the inconvenience, but afterwards, when things settle down, there is the opportunity to look at it in different ways. And I think that by looking at it in different ways, including positive ways, that's a way to reap the greatest benefits from one's life.
Yeah, that is so profound and so true. And I'm always fascinated by people when they tell their stories who have gone through difficult times, challenging times, whatever that may be, but experiencing them down the track from that experience and how it has shaped their lives. In some cases, it's altered their whole destiny and their purpose in life and the quality of their relationships. And, you know, in the end, they were so much better off, so to speak. Their lives had blossomed and flourished in ways that it wouldn't have happened if they didn't go through that situation.
I think that's right. I'm looking at my Facebook page here. A colleague of mine quotes T.S. Eliot. Anxiety is the handmaiden of creativity, T.S. Eliot says. Okay, another gift of adversity. They have anxiety, but it's the handmaiden of creativity. Necessity is the mother of invention. Obstacles cause creativity. One of my favorite stories is when I was in a car as a 9-year-old boy with a neighbor waiting for his children to be let out of an evening activity. And this was a very, very intelligent man. And there was a fly banging up against the windshield, and he said, look at that fly. If only it realized that if it turned around, it could fly out the back window, how much better off it would be. And that was a gift and a revelation right there, that it had other ways that it wasn't aware of. But then he even took it further. He said, and then think of Chuck Yeager, who broke the sound barrier. he was the first man to fly a plane through the sound barrier, going faster than the speed of sound. And what happened was that you pushed the joystick forward and the plane sped up until it came to the speed of sound, and then it began to shake violently. And the pilots would instinctively pull back on the joystick to slow the plane down because it felt like it was about to explode. What Yeager did was he pushed it forward, and in going through the sound barrier, the flight was calm and peaceful after that. And so he made history by pushing the joystick in the opposite direction from what was intuitive to other people. So, yes, adversity, doing things in odd ways, these are the elements of creativity.
And that is so inspirational. You know, I had a guest on my show, and he really touched me. He was a foreign journalist, correspondent, had fractured vertebrae, and it finally just pushed it over the edge, and he basically had his back broken. It was damaged in surgery. They botched it. He was in terrible pain. He used alcohol. He used food and drugs. And he had cancer, throat cancer from depleted uranium, and he was dying. And he made a decision to die sober for his young son. And through that detox center, he actually went and discovered yoga. And through that chance encounter from a decision he made just to die sober and clean, he actually discovered yoga. And he went on to just totally immerse himself in it for 2 years, at which point he healed his cancer, he healed his broken back. He has the ability to do amazing poses in yoga postures, but most of all, he has now found a spiritual path, and he has a yoga center out of San Diego, and he travels all over the world as a very advanced yoga teacher. Now, how inspiring is that story?
I think it's wonderful, because what it shows you, somebody else might say, I'm dying. What can I give to anybody? My life is done. My life's work is done. I'll just go. But this guy said, no, I'm going to give my son a crucial gift in the midst of dying. And that is not an uncommon experience. That is not an many is the case now that I'm looking at it more and more, that the dying and the elderly give us gifts. And as we take care of them, and it's so difficult and so time-consuming and so hard, that gifts come our way from caring for people who've cared for us all our lives. It's a great blessing, really. I have a story in my section on heroes about a hero after whom I was named. My uncle Norman Rosenthal went up to North Africa when he was 20 years old to fight for the Allies against the Nazis in North Africa, which was a bridgehead to occupied Europe, which was hotly contested between the Germans and the Allies, both of whom wanted that precious bridgehead. And he went up as an infantryman, and he went through several battles there, and finally his luck ran out, and he was shot, and he was dying. And we would not know the story if it were not for the ministering of a field padre who tended to him. But they came to him with a very short rations of water, because it was desert and there was not much water to go around, and offered him his rations, and he declined to accept them. He said, please give them to somebody who has a better chance of survival than I do, and refused to take the water and went on to die. Okay, less than 21 years old, not enough time to do anything with his life that would have been regarded as an accomplishment, dying up there, and yet here's a gift that I am fortunate enough to be able to pass on, thanks to the field padre and a brilliant journalist. I have reproduced that article. Because, you see, that was a gift, or that was a courage and a heroism. that was multiplied millions of times over by the members of what has been called the greatest generation, who gave their lives for our freedom and our safety and were exemplary in that regard. And so even when you're dying, you can give people gifts, and I love your story.
And here he is. He stayed with you decades later, inspiring mm-hmm. you and inspiring others.
And now I have the joy of sharing him with you and your listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess we're coming to the end, but I'd just like to ask you, what has been the effect of this book? I guess the first part of that question is, what was the seed that got planted that made you want to express your creative writing in this way, and how has it impacted you personally?
Well, you know, I've been writing for a quarter of a century, and mostly I've been writing popular science. Winter Blues was about seasonal affective disorder, Transcendence about transcendental meditation, the emotional revolution, the science of emotion. So, but always when I would ask people, what do you like best about my writing, they would always say, we love the stories. So I thought, okay, I'm going to give them a book that's just stories with a minimum amount of science or anything else. It's just going to be stories. And I'm going to take a lot of the stories from my own life, but some also from some of the really, really interesting people that I've met, like the great neurologist and Holocaust survivor, Viktor Frankl. I've written a whole chapter about my meeting with him. So I'm just going to take these stories and put them out there. But, you know, a writer never knows, are the stories going to resonate? Are they going to really find a home in the mind of the reader? And the greatest joy and discovery for me in writing this book is that readers have loved it, readers have responded to it. I'm going to read this end of this little Amazon review by someone who is a friend and a colleague and a mentor, Jean Carper, herself a published best-selling author. And she writes at the end, she says, it is Dr. Rosenthal's best book and the best memoir I have read in some time. Get it, enjoy it. I think you will love it and feel much emotionally enriched by it. Well, you can read the whole review on Amazon, but the fact that somebody that I admire and respect so much as Jean Carper would resonate so with these stories. She comes from a different world, a different country, a different gender, a different era, and yet they have resonated with her. That is the greatest gift that a writer can have, to reach out across this wide divide, this vast divide, and find a resonant spirit and a resonant mind and heart in the readers, the by now many thousands of readers that have enjoyed this book. To me, that is the gift that has come back to me from the book. And thank you so very much for letting me share this with your listeners.
Well, it has been a pleasure. It has certainly been the gift of your adversities and how it's impacted so many people's lives and inspired people. So I want to thank you, Dr. Norman Rosenthal. Is the best place for people to learn more about you, your website, normanrosenthal.com?
It is. Thank you for mentioning it, normanrosenthal.com, and it's got all about all my books and various other things, my blogs, things I have written that you freely can access. And thank you for listening, and thank you for having me on your program.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, and all the best, and congratulations again on a very successful endeavor. Okay, bye now. And to all my listeners, thank you. May you turn all your adversities into a plentitude of gifts. And remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.